So, today we're going to complete the study consideration of Heraclitus, 125 fragments using the William Harris translation, professor emeritus of Middlebury College. He died a few years ago, and I read something online about him in an obituary. He's talking about how he's such a good guy, and he seems like a good guy to me, too. This is the DK deals cons ordering of these fragments. And we really finished them all last week, and today is just going to be a final summation, last reading through, homage to Heraclitus, and my own personal comments in conclusion, regarding the matter, regarding this philosophy. First of all, I have a lot of affection for Heraclitus. And I studied him actually even in high school or college a little bit, did a little reading then, and very happy to be in his sphere of light again. And Ra, in the Ra material, did talk about Heraclitus as one of those who had brought forth elements of the Law of One 2,500 years ago. And we have to understand that 2,500 years ago was a hot time on in the old town tonight. Where Gautama, Siddhartha Gautama, Buddha was in India. And actually, there was another guy named Mahavira, who was a Jain teacher, contemporary with Gautama in India too. The Jain, Jain, are more ascetic, but very influential for the Indian religiosity and yoga traditions. And Confucius in China, and Lao Tzu in China, and Heraclitus and Thales or Anaximander and other guys in the Greek area, philosophical zone. So you've got some pretty heavy hitters in China, in Greece, and in China, India, and Greece. So the foundations of modern philosophical understanding, East and West, were very much laid and poured 2,500 years ago, 500 years before Yeshua, in China and India and Greece. Not exactly Greece, but that area. And these, so Heraclitus is one of the most famous of the pre-Socratics. And although most people couldn't understand him, he did influence the Stoics and other philosophical schools later, and Aristotle and Plato, and sort of opened up people's thinking to some very core principles. So opened up Western people's thinking, right? I mean, what happened, Gongzi, Confucius, and Lao Tzu in China, didn't really affect Western culture too much, and Gautama affected all of Asia. But not really the West until until the last century, until the middle of the 19th century, mainly Victorian Englishers doing their best to translate early Buddhism. But Gautama very much was a teacher for all of Asia. And Chuang Tzu or Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, Confucius were really teachers for China. And the Asian sphere, the China, the Sinic, Sinic, Sino Chinese sphere of influence, which is all of East Asia, all of East and Southeast Asia. But the Chinese sphere that goes from what Korea's Japan, China, Vietnam, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Philippines, a little bit, Southeast Asia, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, Burma, Myanmar, Malaysia, all in that zone you have Sinic, all Sinic influence, all influenced by the blend of Confucius and Lao Tzu, or Confucianism, Taoism. One is more social, the other one is more esoteric, Taoism. The foundations for that were set 2,500 years ago by Confucius and Lao Tzu. Then you have religiosity, or the counterpart a counterpart to that for all of Asia, being Buddhism, which is really both a non-culturally specific, non, it's, you know, the Confucianism and Taoism are deeply Chinese, same as Hinduism. But Buddhism, like Christianity, is very acultural or a sectarian or not tied to a certain cultural mindset in the way that Hinduism and Hindu traditions are for the Indians, and Confucianism, Confucius teaching, and Taoism are for Chinese. There's a certain universality, which really is just global, supracultural appeal, supraculturalism, to Buddhism and Christianity. And so Confucius was a great being, but not, I think, in the same way a world teacher offering teachings for hundreds of millions of people all over the world as Gautama and Yeshua, Jesus. Meanwhile, you have then coming out of Greece, the pre-Socratics, and then Plato, Aristotle, and all these other traditions that in many ways set the foundation for Western mind, that also counterbalanced or got influenced the development of Christianity later. So today, I just want to go through the basic sections and just read some quotes without doing much commentary. Some of the fragments that I myself like and that I think are key to Heraclitus' thought. So we'll start with number one. The section is called The Way of the Logos, and the naming of these sections all came either came from Harris or it came from the DK ordering itself, meaning Heraclitus himself didn't write for the didn't categorize or accumulate collect these fragments into his named chapters. These names came later, but this section, later named The Way of the Logos, talking about the Logos, we'll start with one, fragment one. Although this Logos is eternally valid, yet men are unable to understand it, not only before hearing it, but even after they've heard it for the first time. That's to say, although all things come to pass in accordance with this Logos, men seem to be quite without any experience of it. At least if they're judged in the light of such words and deeds as I'm here setting forth, according to its nature, which is physis, and to specify how it behaves, and that's what he's doing. His words are setting forth the nature of the logo, the expression of the logos. Other men, on the contrary, are as unaware of what they do when awake as they are when asleep. Fragment two. We should let ourselves be guided by what is common to all. Yet, although the Logos is common to all, most men live as if each of them had a private intelligence of his own. 3. Men who love wisdom should acquaint themselves with a great many particulars. 4. Seekers after gold dig up much and find little. And 5. Let us not make arbitrary conjectures about the greatest matters. So be careful. 7. Of those whose discourses I have heard, there is not one who attains to the realization that wisdom stands apart from all else. 8. I have searched myself. I have searched myself. 9. It pertains to all men to know themselves and to be temperate. Temperate in this case means the Greek is sophrosune, means safety mind. So know yourself and keep your mind safe. Safe from getting stuck in patterns of thought and feeling that may be hurtful to yourself or others. 10. To be temperate, sophrosune, safe mind, is the greatest virtue. Wisdom consists in speaking and acting the truth, giving heed to the nature of things, meaning phusis, the what is held in common. So, safety in mind, one way of reading this 10. Safety in mind is the greatest virtue. Wisdom consists in speaking and acting the truth, giving heed to the true nature of all that is, meaning living in the common and getting beyond our private opinionatedness to find the principles that we all live within with that the principles that encompass us, or the principles of soul evolution and cosmic plan. How is it that we may heal? What is healing? How is it that we may develop wisdom? What is it? What is balance, really? And how is karma operative that may help us explain how things are in the world today? Going down. 11. The things of which there can be sight, hearing, and learning, these are what I especially prize. 12. Eyes are more accurate witnesses than ears. 13. But 13. Eyes and ears are bad witnesses to men having barbarian souls. So he prizes seeing, hearing, and learning. I want to see, let me see widely, let me see. Let me see a lot. Let me keep seeing. Let me keep listening. Let me try to keep learning. And even if eyes are more accurate than ears, in his view, I'm not sure what that means. There are many ways to talk about it. For men having barbarian souls, eyes and ears are bad witnesses. And that's, when the cow drinks water, turns to milk. When the snake drinks water, turns to poison. And so, be careful of, just like Lin Chi said, just don't follow the deluded views of others. It's good to listen to everyone and listen to everything, but we should understand that people's views very much are determined by their level of development. And a person who doesn't value wisdom and sincerity and truth and fair-mindedness and that which is in common, if they don't value that, their opinions are not going to be too trustworthy. Some things they may know perfectly, some things they may know that we don't know. They may have insight we don't have. On the other hand, they may be, some of their views may be deathly ill and wrong. And as Lin Shi said, just don't follow the deluded views of others. But if they speak truth, we ought to be willing to reform our thinking to accord with the universal truth that they happen to know that we didn't yet know or don't yet know or can't yet integrate and ought to. So, it's not that I love this one or hate that one. The idea would be love truth and be willing to see folly and move out of folly. 14. One should not act or speak as if he were asleep. So it's not a good idea to sleepwalk. 15. The waking have one world in common. 16 continues that death is what we see when awake, and when we are asleep, it is dreams. So death is what we see when awake. Accords perfectly with an esoteric reading of Gautama, Buddhist teaching, that nirvana, blowing out of the flame, is the deathless, is an unbinding associated with the deathless. The deathless is that which doesn't die. That which doesn't die is that which is not born. All that we experience is born and thus dying. Meaning, the body arises, therefore it'll pass away. Thoughts arise, therefore they'll pass away. The body is conditioned and fashioned by multiple elements. So is thought, so is opinion, so is emotion. They arise conditioned by many elements. They are fashioned, they are composite, they are associated with the force of the energetics of the causes that brought them into being as a result, and then eventually will pass away. Body goes back to the dirt. Thoughts dissolve back to the ether. Opinions change. And we also return to a more essential source or beingness after we leave the physical body. And so what we see when awake may be called death, Heraclitus 16 here, from a strict Buddhist view of Gautama, all that arises must pass away. And therefore it's all anicca, impermanent. But what's anicca is also associated with dukkha, because there's no substantial joy in that which is dying. It's already dying. Everything's dying, like the burning house. Now, that's not Buddhist pessimism. That's called realism. That doesn't mean there is no joy. Yeah, there's joy. Yeah, there's bliss. Yeah, there's happiness. Yeah, there's love. And all those too arise and pass away, leaving one again with the taste of death. The taste of death being what arose now is gone. It's gone. It came, it went. That doesn't mean there wasn't joy or love or happiness. Yeah, but it's still dukkha. It's dukkha because it arises and passes away. And being impermanent and unsatisfactory or stressful because of that impermanence, the Buddhist formula goes to anatta, an understanding of emptiness or no self or insubstantiality. That which is always changing and that which is stressful because of it is not myself. It's not the speaker. Who is the speaker? Ramana Maharshi said, you know, who am the practice being, who am I? Who is this? The speaker is deathless. That's the point. The speaker, the source of the speaker is deathless. True man without rank, and she said. And so, and that's what Buddhist teaching is all about, is to move to living in the deathless. Chuang Tzu, Taoist, said, leap into the boundless and make it your home. Leap into the boundless and make it your home, Chuang Tzu, Taoist, great sage, said. So that's why Heraclitus said, death is what we see when awake. And so this is the realm, the realm of birth and death, samsara. We go on. The last passage fragment in this first section about the Logos is 19, and he says, unless you expect the unexpected, you'll never find truth, for it is hard to discover and hard to attain. And so truth is not an easy matter. I wrote this quotation about loving truth. Sometimes it's very painful. Certain truths are painful to behold. Certain truths are glorious to behold. Certain truths demand a massive reformulation of our opinions or the structure of our thinking. And other opinions are deeply, other truths are deeply comforting. You know, sometimes I talk to somebody or older generation folks about reincarnation or life beyond or other dimensions, and one response is, "Oh, that's too good to be true," meaning that we live on and higher dimensions are beautiful. That's too good to be true. Well, it could be quite good, but does that mean that it can't be true because it's so good, or you think it's so good? I mean, come on, let's be logical. So, meanwhile, fragment 19, the importance of expecting the unexpected or expecting what you have never seen before. What is new? The truth that we come, you know, developing understanding means coming to contact, coming into contact with information that is new. Truth, at best, hopefully, some of there is truth that we have never contacted before, therefore it's new. If you are learning it, if you're learning, you're learning what you haven't, what you don't know already, or what's not conscious. Maybe all learning is remembering. Sure, I think so. But you're remembering what you have consciously forgotten, or forgotten and is unavailable to the conscious mind. Now it's available to the conscious mind. That's called new. That's a new a new stream of perspective or perception, a stream or capacity of perception in mind that is new. So it has to be unexpected, meaning you can't know what it is before you get it. You can imagine it, and there's some value to that, and there's a limitation. But the willingness to be taught a thing or two, to discover the limits of how much one knows, and to see how little one knows, and the love or the longing or the joy of discovery of the new, the unexpected, is the heart of the one who keeps learning and finding truth, and therefore moves to wisdom. And so it is also hard to discover. Whoa. Sorry. I have a blue skink, and my blue skink is so happy. I think she's a she, just jumped on my leg in the middle. A blue skink is a lizard about 4 or 5 inches long with a bright blue tail. And she must be so happy. I think she's a lady, a young girl. She's so happy with this, she just jumped on my leg. I live near the forest, so there you go. See? I didn't expect it, her, to jump on me, but I have now been taught a thing or two. So there you go. But at least I didn't have a heart attack. So, unless you expect the unexpected, you'll never find truth. And so the willingness to be found mistaken, the willingness to find oneself mistaken. Oh, I've been mistaken. Oh, there's so much more that I didn't know. That humility or willingness is really important to finding truth and really important to the development of wisdom. The second section, the idea of the continuum, starts with fragment 20. These are some of the most famous fragments of Heraclitus associated with the idea of ceaseless change at all levels being the only constant of creation, that strife, this continual change of polarized elements or multiple elements is the way by which phenomena appears and disappears. There's a unification of opposites. There's a intrinsic strife or conflictual or war nature to that. That continual change is akin to war or strife or conflict. And the primary element we may understand is fire. Fire as the essential vibratory quality of all phenomena and mind, which leads to perpetual change and the continuum and cyclicity, or the identity, the unity of polarity. Polarity exists within unity. Polarity is a visible manifestation of unity. So night, day, up, down, the upward, downward path. The path upward and downward are one and the same. Meanwhile, strictly logically, based on impermanence, we can't even say that there are things alternating, or that there are eternally substantial entities that we're calling the pair of a polarity. So, and that this continual changefulness is actually a form of justice or sanctity of the logos. Dike Eris means strife is justice. That's also very Taoist. So, fragment 20. They do not step into the same rivers. It is other and still other waters that are flowing. So, the river, the contour of the river is always changing. The water in the river is always changing. The one who's walking in is always changing. Our opinions and perceptions of it visually kinesthetically, in all ways, are always changing. This is the famous statement. They do not step into the same rivers. It is other and still other waters that are flowing. And 21, you cannot step twice into the same river for other waters, and yet others go ever flowing on. They go forward and back again. So there's this alternation, or there's the expression of the appearance of a polarity. Water going forward, water going back, water from back over there coming here, going out to the other place, past, present, future. Yet, so there's this eternal change. Well, that's not a big deal. That's not a, I mean, a profound principle. However, in many, many ways, we act as if we're dealing with static phenomena. That's a very deep, I can't get into it here, but a word to the wise, the value of reflection or meditation on the principle of impermanence, continual change, alternation, polarity, flux, streaming, the value of looking at that or reflecting on it, meditating on it, and taking that opinion, that principle very seriously, is that in many, many ways, most of which are unconscious, we live our life as if what we're dealing with within ourselves and others and relationship and phenomena and decisions are all static entities rather than in continual flux whose essential identity ultimately can't be found. We really live as if there isn't continual impermanence. We assume static entities all over the place. I'm angry. I'm Scott. We identify ourselves this way and that. We identify situations and options and choices this way and that, and are stuck in all of them, generally. And many, have a great aversion to change, yet all we're experiencing is change. 22. Cool things become warm. The warm grows cool. The moist dries. The parched become moist. So the alternation of the polarity of temperature, warm and cool, and moisture, moist and dry. The lower elements, earth, water. The higher elements, fire, air. 1, 2, 3, 4. Earth, water, fire, air. Fifth element is called space, fifth ray. Continually alternating, substituting, reversing, coming, going, cycling. 23. It is in changing that things find repose. So this is a guy who can rest. In change, the creation shows its ease. The Tao, that we the phenomena that we intrinsically believe to be static are actually eternally shifting and flowing and streaming and mutating and alternating and morphing. So phenomena and mind is continually morphing, changing shape, changing form, changing quality, changing energetic, vibrating, continually vibrating. Meanwhile, we take it as if it's relatively static. Meanwhile, that continual morphing of all and shifting and phase changing continually is a kind of repose or rest or justice, because that's all there is. The flickering never ends. 24. Time is a child, moving counters in a game. The royal power is a child's. So there's an innocence to it, innocence to it. 25, talking about war as strife, as fire, as continual change. War is both father and king of all. Some he's shown forth as gods and others as men, and some he's made slaves and others free. This is like the wheel of fortune, karma, always changing. Every incarnation, we've got different situations. 26. It should be understood that war is the common condition, that strife is justice, and that all things come to pass through the compulsion of strife. So strife is justice is dike eris, strife is repose. That's very subtle. So the tapestry is ever shimmering, and all light is ever vibrating. That is its stability. And 27, the end of the section, Homer was wrong in saying, quote, "Would that strife might perish from amongst gods and men," end quote. Heraclitus says, "For if that were to occur," meaning the ending of strife, "then all things would cease to exist." So, going on the next section on nature. And again, nature means physis, is the Greek is physis, physis, which really means true nature or essential nature, talking about ontology. 28. There is exchange of all things for fire, and of fire for all things, as there is of wares for gold, and of gold for wares. And so it is fire, in a sense, that's being exchanged, or fire is driving the continuum. The continuum is driven by fire. The strife or war is driven by fire, if we want to elementalize it. 29. This universe, which is the same for all, has not been made by any god or man, but it always has been, is, and will be an ever-living fire, kindling itself by regular measures and going out by regular measures. So the universe, the logos, what's in common, it's the same for all. The principles of our path and the principles of cosmic structure and plan are the same for all. It has not been made by any human. It has not been made by any god. There is no Satan. Sorry, there is no Lucifer. Sorry, there is God, but there's no Lucifer. Sorry, there really isn't. There's Orion and countless minions on the astral plane and 40 negative and their teachers above them. Yeah, but there is no Lucifer. There is no Satan. Sorry, he doesn't exist. However, there is God, and there are angels, and then there are many higher dimensional beings. Buddhism, there are gods, there are devas and asuras, positively oriented and negatively oriented, love-based and rejecting of love, in higher dimensions up to the logos. There's only one God. There's no God but God. There's no creator in the realm of the creation. The creation is a manifestation of the creator, and the creator is the true nature of all that manifests or all creation. But the laws are made by the logos, not by humans. And that's the point. If we want to get with the program, we've got to know what it is. But you didn't make the program. But there are principles that we ought to know. And if we don't know them, we get into trouble. Like, US legal system says, ignorance of the law is no defense. Well, you can say, I didn't know, but karma works whether you believe it or not. Kindling itself by regular measures and going out by regular measures, so there's a regularity, that's karma. There's an order, action, equal and opposite reaction. There's intrinsic order. 30. He calls it, or Heraclitus perhaps calls it, craving and satiety. So there's desire, hunger, for coming into being. And then there's satiety or fullness, which leads to coming out of being. There's that which leads to creation and arising, and there's that which leads to passing away and cessation. So birth, old age, sickness, and death, Buddhism. Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, arising, coming into being. Persisting, degenerating, decaying, and coming out of being and dying or ceasing. That's led by craving and satiety. The whole universe as a big mouth, as a big eating situation. Eating and vacating. 31. It throws apart and then brings together again. It advances and retires. And so that's what the continuum is. Breaking things apart and recollection, going forward and going back, arising, passing away. And so 34, fire lives in the death of earth, air and the death of fire, water and the death of air, and earth and the death of fire. So that's a philosophical approach or usage of the term death. It doesn't mean some guy dying. It really means elemental dissolution or the deconstruction of fashionings and compounds and composites, samskaras passing away, phenomena, phenomenological items, objects, name and form, stuff being fashioned, persisting, and then degenerating or disintegrating, coming out of integration. And so we may see that in the four elements, the lower two, earth, water, the higher two, fire, air, as continual interplay, where all is coming into being, persisting, and then dissolving. So elemental flux leads to the temporary arising appearance of structures or compounds or fashioned composites, compounded dhammas, and then by time they start to disintegrate and move to dissolve and dissolve and pass away and return to the elemental states. That's called life. That's vibration. That's dancing light. And so, as to who's guiding that, 35, Heraclitus says, the thunderbolt pilots all things through all things. 36, the sun is, as Heraclitus states, not only new each day, but forever continually new. The logos is forever continually new. And the last two, comparing the material to the immaterial. 40, the fairest universe is but a heap of rubbish piled up at random. In the sense that the created is the glory of the created is minuscule compared to the glory of the creator. 41, finally, every beast is driven to pasture by a blow. And so spiritual work is normally done by the catalyst of discomfort. And this planet provides a fine reservoir of catalyst of discomfort, and particularly this time at the end of the 3D cycle. Next section, called On the Spiritual, starts at 42. These are lovely for me. These fragments will only go for another 15 minutes or so. I can't read all. 42. You could not discover the limits of soul, even if you traveled by every path in order to do so. Such is the depth of its meaning. 43. Soul is the vaporization out of which everything else is composed. Moreover, it is the least corporeal of things and is in ceaseless flux, even so. For the moving world can only be known by what is in motion. Now, there was a question mark, or there was some bracket here. Soul is the vaporization out of which everything else is composed. It's sort of saying that sentience is the basis of light. If it's logoic sentience or logoic soul, I think that's true. But it's also true that we make soul by the distillation of love light, by efficient use of catalyst or learning, spiritual learning or self-transformation during incarnation. During each incarnation, if we learn anything, meaning we develop green, blue, indigo, and help unblock red, yellow, red, orange, yellow. Right? Lower chakra blockages are released somewhat. Higher chakras, love, wisdom, balance, and will, 4, 5, 6, are developed somewhat, hopefully. That is a distillation of love light by efficient use of catalyst. That is the soul making per incarnation. That we may say is sort of the homage to God or Atman. That is spiritual transformation. But Heraclitus is sort of saying that this vaporization or distillation of soul actually is the essential nature out of which everything else comes. So everything is soul. The world is soul. The world's soul is everywhere around you. But this is also basically saying that the sentient light, the sentience, well, all that is a manifestation of energy. Energy fields that take form, that have form, that are associated with material form. And those material form energy fields are essentially vibrating. And that vibration is sentience or awareness or consciousness. So it's sentient light or consciousness, conscious vibration, conscious energy. The universe is alive. The universe is a being. The universe is sentient. And that means that all that it created is soulful. And the world soul, we live in the world soul, and our body is established by the world soul, which is really the logoic, soul of the logos. 45, soul has its inner law, its own inner law of growth. 46, a dry soul is wisest and best. The best and wisest soul is a dry beam of light. Super esoteric. The best and wisest soul is a dry beam of light. Meanwhile, unfortunately or fortunately for experience, 47, souls take pleasure in becoming moist. And then there's a second part here. We live in the death of souls, and they in our death. It means that the higher, in many ways, is born of the transformation out of the lower. And that's the case, in the case of developing, fourth and fifth and sixth chakras. It can only be done when we're willing to move out of attachment to the lower. It's not that we can't enjoy earth and water. Right? We should enjoy the pleasures of moisture. But it's a matter of becoming attached to them, or enjoyment with or without love or wisdom. There's enjoyment of earth and water with love and wisdom, and there's attachment and distortion of a very poor quality of enjoyment of earth and water, the moist, without developed love and wisdom, too. There are different ways of enjoying or living in the world of earth, water. 48. A drunken man has to be led by a boy whom he follows stumbling and not knowing whither he goes, for his soul is moist. 49. It is death to souls to become water, and it is death to water to become earth. Conversely, water comes into existence out of earth and souls out of water. So this drying, dry, the soul grows good, Brooks Haxton translation. This drying is the development of fire air, which really is the use of third chakra and decision, intellectual decision, clarity, reason, rationality, to choose to move out of blockage, to move out of attachment to earth, water, lower first, second chakra, body oriented, body identified, emotionally identified, emotionally clinging, craving, materialism. To move out of that. It's not that we there's anything bad with it. It's just that attachment to it keeps us from the development of love, wisdom, and balance and higher qualities. It's not a matter of rejecting the lower for the higher. It's really a matter of including the higher in our more enlightened experiencing of the lower. There really is higher or lower if we want to look at verticality. There's no right and wrong. However, if you overvalue earth water, you will not understand fire air and the dry beam of light. Meanwhile, if you seek to understand fire air and the dry beam of light, you will have a more a wiser and more mature and more satisfying relationship to earth water and moisture. So anyway, thank you so much for being here. See you next time, and good night.